I'm Duncan McLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast. I'm joined now by Fikile Sibiya, Chief Information Officer at E4. Fikile, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for making the time to talk to Tech Central today.
Thanks, Duncan. I'm really excited to be having this talk.
Fantastic. So this is actually the third in a series of really interesting podcasts that we are recording with E4. If you missed the first two in the series, I can highly recommend going back and having a listen to those. You can just search E4 on Tech Central, and those will come up. Those were with Andrea Tucker and Carla Diabrio. I'm starting to wonder if there are any men working for E4, Fikile.
If I remember correctly, July, August, or actually a year is dedicated to women. Men just don't have space. We do have men at E4. They're just not in the spotlight like the women are.
Haven't met them yet. Okay.
just haven't met them yet.
All right. Excellent. Well, welcome to the podcast. We were chatting ahead of our conversation today about the impact of the pandemic and the lockdown measures on IT leadership in South Africa. Now, you're a chief information officer. I know you have your background is in the banking industry, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Where you've held senior IT leadership roles. You joined E4, I think, just as the lockdown was starting back in March of 2020. Was it a bit of a baptism by fire for you? Take me through it.
Yeah, I mean, very interesting, Duncan. My very first assignment at E4 was to enable a remote workforce. So I joined the organization, and a week later, on a Sunday, I got a message to say I need to be at the office at 8 o'clock in the morning because there's an urgent meeting. And the meeting was saying, from today, we're going to be sending the staff to work from home, and you need to make it happen. I didn't know much about the organization yet at that point. And I didn't have a lot of context at that point as yet. And I needed to make it happen. And it's 18 months later. Who would have thought? And we've been working remotely since that day.
So how ready was E4 for this transition? I imagine for many CIOs and many organizations, it was a bit of a shock to the system, particularly for organizations that hadn't set up, remote video conferencing tools like Zoom, like Teams, etc. And suddenly they were forced into the situation where their entire workforce were working remotely. How prepared was E4 for this, and how did you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Duncan, a lot of organizations and a lot of IT leaders were caught off guard, really, because, I mean, it's not like we're given the time to prepare. It's a pandemic and, we were in crisis mode, almost immediately. At E4, we were quite fortunate because the transition was quite seamless in that we already had the tools to enable a remote workforce. So literally people packed up on the day we had to start working remotely. And the very next day, people were already connecting on Microsoft Teams for meetings and taking calls on Skype for Business. I mean, mm-hmm. Our entire call center left the offices. We just had to give them the hardware to enable them with their remote working. But in terms of the technology and our digital transformation, we were quite ahead at that point. And I mean, it was very fortunate for us in terms of the transition. And certainly for me as a new leader, it was quite empowering to realize that the work was not as cut out for me as I thought it was.
Indeed. And I'm sure you had other priorities as you were joining the organization and you had to pivot suddenly to focus
on this. Absolutely.
It must have been quite a stressful time. I'm not suggesting specifically for E4, but for IT leaders across the board, because, I think IT leaders are naturally fairly cautious people. You don't want to rush into making decisions and transforming your business because of the risk involved in rushing through changes in IT management systems. Suddenly, I think a lot of organizations, a lot of CIOs and other IT leadership, people in IT leadership roles were suddenly forced to move exceptionally quickly. And I'm sure this put them under a lot of stress as well. How have you found it in talking to your clients, your CIO clients in the industry? How have they managed to cope through all of this?
So, it was chaotic, Duncan. And talking to some of the colleagues in the industry, some organizations had to even purchase laptops. I don't know if you noticed, but there was quite a big shortage of laptops for quite some time around that point, because obviously logistics were impacted and there was a lot of demand for hardware. And also, I mean, a lot of organizations, as you said, were steadily moving towards their digital transformation. Mm. And overnight, those journeys had to be, expedited and moved quite quickly. And I mean, it was very, very stressful. And I mean, how do you, the change management around it as well for a workforce that was used to working a certain way? And now you having them adapt to working from home, adapt to new technologies, adapt to new ways of working, adapt to new ways of collaborating. So it was very, very stressful. And a lot of, I think, the pressure was certainly on IT leaders, companies were looking at IT leaders to make it happen. You guys talk technology, you need to make it happen. We need the continuity. And budgets, I mean, the prior year, IT leaders had set up budgets a certain way, to achieve certain objectives. And suddenly, just the twisting and the shifting of those budgets, and in certain occasions, asking for more budget just to enable the new construct. So very, very stressful for a lot of leaders. But I think it was a big lesson as well in the industry, Duncan, to say we cannot, pay lip service to digital transformation. It is a necessity in this day and age. And I think the pandemic has just really highlighted that point. And I have no doubt in my mind that any boardroom you go into, digital transformation is not the last point on the agenda. It's probably top of mind. Given what we've just gone through. So yeah, it was really stressful, but very big lessons to be taken from that.
Looking at from the people perspective, this must have been a very stressful exercise. I know we're 18 months into this pandemic now, but I imagine that CIOs and their IT teams were put under enormous pressure through this period. Has there been a lot of burnout? Have people been struggling personally through these times in terms of work overload? And from an E4 perspective, how do you manage that sort of thing?
No, certainly, Duncan. I mean, just thinking about my own personal life, having to carve out the distinction between personal life and a work life was very hard. And a lot of, the burnout came from just the adjustment and making the distinction between the two worlds that suddenly overnight literally had to merge into one. Children at home don't really understand that you're at work. They see mommy is home and mommy is meant to be home. So a lot of it really came from all of us psychologically adapting to this new way. But I mean, at E4, like I said earlier, the fortunate part for us is that most people were already used to working from home. I mean, we work with dev teams that sort of manage their time and manage their workloads, so to say. They're used to that kind of a life. But for some of our staff members that are not so much, in the technical spaces, they did struggle. And I mean, projects had to continue in the midst of the adoption of the new ways, as well as the navigating the changes and the uncertainty, the anxiety and all of it. It was just a mixed bag of so many disciplines and so many things. We did have staff members that did take a knock in terms of having burnouts and not coping. Some of our young guys stay alone at home, and suddenly you isolated from the world. And that does cause a lot of stress. But fortunately, I mean, we've got quite a very supportive HR team. And they were always on the lookout for such cases and providing that support in terms of mental health and mental wellness to ensure that our staff members can navigate that tough territory. So, I mean, we relied a lot on our wellness partners as well as our HR teams and partnered with them to say, guys, the changes that are coming just from a technology perspective, it's quite immense. And, we're going to need the support to ensure that our staff remain empowered and supported during the time. So it was certainly stressful for a lot of staff members.
Yeah, and a lot of companies, a lot of IT leadership must have felt that they were working at Facebook, whose motto I think has always been work fast and break things or something along those lines. And I imagine a lot of IT processes and systems were broken.
Of course.
as people had to just improvise and get things done in the moment.
As
this crisis broke. Now, I imagine CIOs are now looking back at the last 18 months and starting to look at some of the things that got broken along the way, things that can be done better, et cetera, et cetera. But Figile, what are some of the positives you think that came out of this whole experience?
So I think for me, it's really been, you know, we can do it. Just the human spirit and the human resilience around it. And I mean, we at E4, some of our major projects happened remotely. Mm-hmm. We did, you know, very big projects. I think one of our biggest projects to date, we did it remotely. And I think, you know, it was just an awakening to say, actually, you know, we can. You know, we can change, we can adapt to new ways, we can adapt to new technologies, and there's nothing to be scared of, you know, with this digital transformation. Sometimes we hold on to legacy and we hold on to what we know. Mm. And I think the positive is just really, it is possible and we can, you know, sounds cliche, but really the world of possibility when you put technology to the test. And you partner technology with human beings, because that's exactly what we did.
Yeah.
And just the endless possibilities in that.
And there must have been some specific challenges. And all companies have obviously been through these challenges. And one of them that's very specific to South Africa is load shedding. During these lockdowns, we also had load shedding. How do you cope with that? I mean, how did E4 deal with these additional demands we have as South Africans, such as load shedding, such as, I suppose it's a global thing, but also just managing people's ability to connect.
Yeah, so, you know, initially when we went on lockdown, I don't know if you remember, but Eskom was very kind to South Africans, you know, and the workforce of South Africa. We didn't have load shedding for quite some months. Mm. But we always knew at the back of our heads as leaders that at some point it's going to come. And what we did at E4 is we're quite, you know, deliberate and proactive in how we're going to manage that scenario. And really, the work we do, Duncan, mostly it's, you know, we've got a workforce that can work, you know, at any time of the day.
Yeah.
And we prioritized our client-facing teams that had to be online 24/7. And we kitted them up with backup power. So UPSs, I mean, they were quite a bit on the market at quite affordable, you know, prices. And we just gave them sort of that that continuity, mm-hmm. You know, for their homes where, you know, when you've got load shedding, they could plug in and continue working. The challenge came with the connectivity. Because sometimes, you know, when there's load shedding, I don't know if you notice on your side, but you at some point lose your connectivity just from a network perspective. And that's been the challenge we've had, and it's a challenge we continue to have. And I think it's felt across the country. But I mean, we really just do try and manage it within the confines that we have as best as we can. And we really haven't seen a huge impact. And some of our clients have been sympathetic, because when we go through it, you know, chances are the whole country is going through it at that point in time.
Mm.
But yeah, it's just really trying to build that layer of continuity as best as we can, and that layer of resiliency in our processes, and in our systems. You know, when we do get load shedding.
Now, I'm sure it's not the easiest thing in the world to measure productivity, but I've spoken to a lot of companies over the last 18 months, and they've given different views on the impact that these work from home measures have had on employee productivity. Some have said that it's been terrible for productivity and we can't wait for people to get back into the office. I know the CEO of Netflix, for example, has said, this isn't sustainable. All of our employees have to go to work. Google as well is also putting a lot of pressure on its employees to return to the office. In fact, I think they said that that we can't guarantee that you're going to be remunerated at the same level if you continue to work from home, which is a very interesting approach. In terms of productivity, what have you found as a company as E4? Did your productivity go up? Was it about the same, or did it go down?
I think without being biased, I think it went up, to be quite frank.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, Duncan. You mentioned some of the big tech giants. You know, we would have, you know, generally thought, yeah, I mean, Netflix has got this. You know, they figured this out. Google, I was actually quite surprised. You know, when Google came out and said we want our staff back at the offices by September, you know, I was just looking at a study the other day, and it's quite interesting how varying opinions around the whole, do we continue working from home or do we send staff back to offices? And I mean, Microsoft, for example, went with a hybrid model.
Yes.
Whereas I looked, some of the big international banks wanted a full, you know, return to the office option. And it was just very interesting to say, you know, what exactly informs those kinds of decisions. I mean, Google said we've got great facilities where our staff can collaborate, you know, over a table tennis game or a cup of coffee. You know, I guess, you know, there's a lot of investment that went into those facilities, et cetera, and you want your staff to use them. In our case, I mean, we have had some staff members who came and said, look, I'm not really coping at home and I would like the flexibility to be back at the office. And the model we've sort of gone with is a hybrid model, mm-hmm. where we want the offices to be available for staff to come in. And, you know, if you at your best and thrive in a structured office environment, it's got to be available. But we also have staff members who have said, no, I'm very happy working from home. I'm at my best. I'm at my most, you know, creative and productive. And we need to enable that, you know, as IT leaders. So for me, we haven't seen a drop in productivity. Certainly not. I mean, like I said earlier, we've delivered some of our biggest projects, working remotely. So we just make the accommodation for the staff members who thrive in an office environment and make an accommodation for staff who thrive in a sort of, remote, environment. I think the whole aim is we need to facilitate the best, you know, of both worlds. So find the employees at their most creative, and it's not a you know, one shoe fits all type scenario. And we just have to make both happen.
Yeah, I imagine that lockdown was music to the ears of introverts and. Absolutely.
Of course.
Absolutely hated by extroverts who just can't wait to get back into the office.
No, absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Interesting. But funny enough, I mean, most of our workforce have opted to work remotely. So it's quite interesting.
Well,
say something
IT,
about IT people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bankers can do it, eh?
But one question that really interests me about this whole work from home model, and it's been going on, this grand global experiment, if I can call it, that's been going on for 18 months now. And that's what impact it has on company culture. Now, culture, I think, is quite a complicated or complex thing that develops over time. And if your employees are mostly working remotely and using Microsoft Teams or Zoom to communicate and do their work, do you retain and develop a unique culture in that way? Can you use technology to ensure that you have a unique culture, or does it end up becoming all homogenous? You end up destroying what was a unique identity as an organization.
Interesting. talking about culture, and the question is, you know, the last 18 months, what really is culture, you know? So what I've seen, or what we've seen at E4, is different teams develop different cultures. I mean, obviously our values bring us together and they center us as an organization. But we found that different teams just organically created their own cultures. So we've got team members who, you know, they'll collaborate on teams and they've got Friday drinks together on Teams, and you come okay. on at a certain time on a Friday afternoon, you bring your drink, and you know, you have your thing as a team. And we've got other teams who, they work while sitting on a Teams call, and mm-hmm. that's their office for the day, and yeah. And that's what they do. So different teams have come up with different strategies, you know, to create their own culture, and what works for them to work together while they're not sitting in one environment. So I think we've just seen different differences in different mm-hmm. cultures, and we've allowed it, you know, to evolve. And as a leadership, we've allowed it to be what it is. I mean, I've seen teams that have got pizza once a month together, and they'll order Uber Eats or, you know, vouchers, and everyone gets their pizza delivered at their door, mm-hmm. And then they come on board and they're having their pizza and just talking about this and the other. So I think a company that has got strong values and a strong ethos will remain grounded in those values, and they'll be centered around those values. But in terms of the culture, from a, you know, the loose culture, as I call it, mm-hmm. I think you just watch it evolve. You know, different people come up with creative ways to collaborate and build, you know, culture and the meaningful working environment for themselves.
Yeah.
And we've seen that happen, guys creating what is meaningful for them and what works for the specific culture. And we just organic, you know, let it grow organically. And there's magic in that, allowing people to be creative around their cultures.
Yeah, it's really interesting how technology is actually allowed. Because imagine if this pandemic had hit 10 years ago and we were all sitting on ADSL connections or 3G, it would have been a very different world. I don't think it actually would have been possible. And it may, you know, if this had happened 10 years hence, it could have been very different once again. Because in 10 years from now, augmented reality and virtual reality will probably be quite commonplace, and it'll be like your colleagues are in the room with you using augmented reality solutions.
Absolutely. 2 years from now, maybe even 18 months from now, yes. I think we'll start seeing a huge acceleration in some of those technologies, seeing what happened, you know.
Mm. Interesting. Now, I know something you're passionate about is change management. Now, that must be something quite difficult to do in a work from home environment where no one is, or very few people are actually in the office. How do you manage change management? I think I'm using the word managed many times here, when people are working remotely.
Sure, very difficult. How do you manage change? It's difficult when people are together, but even harder when teams are working, you know, remotely. Because also the magnitude of change, Duncan has, I mean, it was quite phenomenal what we've gone through over the last 18 months. So I think for us, it was just around keeping the communications alive, and ensuring that people still understand that they belong to a whole. So you're sitting at home alone, you interact with your team, you know, on a regular, but there's a bigger organization outside of that. So what we've managed to do quite well as a leadership team has been keeping the communication channels open. Mm-hmm. So we get our staff together. I mean, initially, we had a full-on staff meeting almost every second week of the month, just to let guys know what's going on, what to expect. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no need to be anxious, et cetera, et cetera. And now we've got one big team meeting once a month, which has really been helpful, you know, because you introduce change to the organization, you communicate it, and then you follow up in the smaller teams, you know, afterwards. But I think communication has really been key for us during this time, and just ensuring that you're taking the team into your confidence, as a leadership team, you know, to say we're in this together. We've got this. We don't have it all figured out, but we'll figure it together, and we're on this journey together. And that has really, really been helpful, because now you allow the organization to focus on what's important, because you take away the noise and the anxiety, from the system. So I think that for us has really, really, been helpful. Communicate, yeah. communicate.
Yeah, I imagine that's key to the whole thing, because if there isn't adequate communication, then people's doubts start to rise, anxiety starts to rise.
No, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, guys, I mean, you're hearing of your family members, your friends losing their jobs every mm-hmm. single day, and you start thinking, goodness, is it going to come to me? And it's for us as leaders to say, no, hang on, we're on this train and we're on it together.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, for the greater good, we just all need to hold hands and, you know, just go through it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think communication can never be underrated when you're trying to manage change from such a, an environment.
Now, top of mind for any chief information officer or chief information security officer, which is a fairly new role, but a growing, expanding role within organizations, is obviously security. A lot of companies have had to do, as we mentioned, had to move fast and break things. And security may have played second fiddle, at least in the early stages of the pandemic. What are your views on this, and how has industry coped with the security response or the security requirements around work from home?
Sure. Yeah. So I think for almost every, you know, IT leader, that has been quite a challenge, because what the pandemic did is it forced, you know, this rapid transition to remote working. And that what meant is that there was suddenly a huge demand in terms of the reliance on digital infrastructure and services. Now, when that happens, what essentially happens is that the attack surface just increases. You know, so there's just that many more avenues for potential cyber attacks. And I think also we need to acknowledge, Duncan, that, you know, cyber criminals are not sleeping. They're really active 24/7. And I think one of the things that happened with the whole remote working and the pandemic is, you know, there was a lot of anxiety in people, a lot of uncertainty, and a lot of fear. And I think cyber criminals took advantage of that. Opportunistic cyber criminals took advantage of that, and preying on people. And what we've seen was a rise in phishing attacks and social engineering. You know, guys coming on board, sending, you know, emails, you know, with, you know, funny attachments, but, playing on the psychological impact, that the crisis and the pandemic had on people. And I think the angle, you know, we took as an organization was that, people need to be, gatekeepers, you know, for security and to keep us safe from a lot of the cyber criminal cyber activities, and education, you know, educating the workforce as a mitigating measure has been really, really helpful, because, you know, creating the awareness to say, listen, this is an opportunity for, you know, for cyber criminals to take advantage of the situation. Be careful, you know, of the emails that you get, and just raising that awareness, building the education around such activities has been really, really helpful. And I think just alerting each and every single person to say we are all responsible. It's not a job of IT. It's a job of anyone that owns a tech, you know, a machine and interacts with technology on a day-to-day basis. And just really raising that awareness and saying, if you see something and you're not sure of, instead of opening it, send it forth to someone that can help you with it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we really also, similar to, I think, a lot of IT leaders, we had to go through, you know, through that to make sure that our workforce is quite aware and sensitized to such activities.
And of course, data privacy has become a big focus as well during this period, and the Protection of Personal Information Act, or PAPIA, came into full force recently, just a few weeks ago, I think. And there's GDPR, which many South African companies have to be aware of as well, because they sell into European organizations, or they deal with European consumers. Has this complicated things for CIOs? It made life much more complicated while they're trying to deal with a crisis. They've also got this privacy legislation to deal with.
Of course, yeah, and the two things sort of coincided, hey? Because I mean, when the pandemic happened, we were just, I think, about 12 months, you know, on a 12 months runway to PAPIA going live. So, I mean, it was challenging, but I think it presented an opportunity as well, because now you need to educate a workforce around security and security awareness, and cyber attacks. And I think that we use that certainly as an opportunity to, because I mean the two things are quite intertwined. You know, we use that as an opportunity to also educate on data privacy and the importance of security, data privacy, and just respecting people's data. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is we sort of co-joined the awareness pieces. You know, we talk about security, data security, data privacy, you know, also leading up to the Papaya compliance go live, and just, you know, had one big sort of awareness and increasing the awareness of the stuff in security as well as data privacy. But I think so when the pandemic happened, we were already on a journey for data privacy, for the Papaya Act implementation. And we had to carry on with that remotely as well. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I mean, it just presented a great opportunity for the awareness and the training part for our staff members, because obviously, you know, it became even more important to make sure that people understand how to handle customer data as well as employee data while they are working remotely. You know, sometimes guys think the controls that are at the office don't extend to their homes, and they leave their machine, you know, open in a home environment, which is risky. So educating them that just because we're not at the office doesn't abdicate us of the responsibility to look after data from a security and a privacy perspective. So yeah, I think it presented a good opportunity.
Yeah.
From that sense,
it does sound to me though that if you work in IT, you're pretty much ready for a holiday right about now.
We've been ready for a holiday for the last 18 months. It hasn't happened yet, but yeah.
Hopefully this December.
Hopefully.
Great. Well, Figile, let's change tack a little bit. I know that fintech is an area that you're particularly passionate about, and we've seen a lot of interesting developments and growth in the fintech sector here in South Africa over the last 18 months. A lot of it, I imagine, you're going to tell me, was driven by the pandemic and people looking for alternative solutions. In fact, we've seen some incredible fundraising rounds happening just in the last couple of months. In the last few weeks, there have been a few announcements of fintech startups securing millions and millions in funding. So there's quite a lot of exciting stuff happening in that space in South Africa. In your view, is the whole concept of fintech accelerated by the pandemic, and where is this taking us?
Yeah, certainly, Duncan. Yeah, I mean that is one of my passions. But I think for me, the acknowledgement around the importance of fintechs when the pandemic happened was just it was amazing. It was just fascinating, because suddenly what we saw was, you know, fintechs were at the forefront, you know, with some of the big companies in terms of partnering to ensure that there's continuity in the economy. And I mean, if you look at what we do at E4, we were able to provide continuity to our clients. I mean, they could literally pack up and go home, and they could continue doing what they do because we provide web-based solutions at E4. So as a fintech, you know, it was just so liberating to see that we can enable our customers to continue even in a crisis situation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of fintechs really played a big role in that sense. In the South African context, there's a lot of an unbanked population. And a lot of informal players in the economy. And I think there's very big opportunities for fintechs to stand in that gap, you know, and partner with big banks and big financial services providers to stand in that gap. I mean, if you think about it, when the lockdown happened, what did it mean for spaza shops that couldn't move freely to get their goods and replenish their stock? And some of them needed financial relief, but because they're in the sort of informal sector, you find that they don't have bank statements and stuff like that to access the relief provided by government or access funds from the banks. So I think there's a very big opportunity for fintechs, and I'd really, it would be great to see, you know, a lot of activity in that space, just looking at, you know, the unbanked or the underbanked sector in the country and how we come in then as fintechs to plug some of those gaps. But certainly I think the pandemic has really just heightened the awareness around the critical role that fintechs can play and how then fintechs partner with some of the big providers to close that gap and to provide that sort of assurance or security for some of the lower segment or the underbanked players in the economy.
Yeah, I imagine the opportunity is actually pretty massive if you think about it. South Africa may be in a unique position here in that we have a fairly well-developed financial sector, formal financial sector in South Africa, but we've also got a large unbanked population that's hungry for fintech solutions. Smartphone penetration is enormous now, and so there is a huge opportunity here to develop solutions that could then be exported to the rest of the continent, to other markets around the world, which are also underbanked.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's such a huge opportunity. And I mean, you know, there's just varying things in that banket, Duncan. I mean, I only mentioned spaza shops, but I think the entire ecosystem, because I mean, if a spaza shop needs to replenish their stock, you know, there's a transaction there with some of the warehouses and suppliers from that perspective, all the way down to how the consumer accesses those goods from that sense. So I think there's a lot of opportunities. What the pandemic also brought to the play was the idea around contactless transacting. Yeah. You know, where I don't want to see you, you don't want to see me, I don't want to touch you, you don't want to touch me, but we want to transact. And how does that happen? How do we facilitate that? So there's another big opportunity. So I think really it's really shown us the amount, the endless possibilities. And I mean, it's interesting to see that fintechs are now getting the recognition and getting the funding that they need to make it all happen, because I think there is an acknowledgement that we did step in and help provide some of that continuity when the pandemic happened.
It's fascinating what you say about contactless payments, because I remember before the pandemic, people were really nervous about these things. And I remember people saying, there's no way I'm going to touch my card at the point of sale. I mean, it can't be secure. I'm just not going to do it. Then COVID hit. Now everyone does it.
Everyone does it, and everyone demands it, right? Exactly. Everyone demands it, and and the response needs to be, you know, as rapid as well. So I think it just really, for me, the pandemic, the positive that came out of it was just, you know, technology is here. We need to adopt it. We need to embrace it. We need to partner with it to ensure that, you know, we're defining a new world, because that's exactly what we're doing. So how do we define a new world where technology and human beings live together? And it's done that. It's really taken us leaps and bounds in terms of starting to think about those things.
Well, I think a really positive note on which to end the podcast. Fikile Sibiya is Chief Information Officer at E4. Fikile, if anyone wants to know more about E4 and what it is you guys do, what is your website again?
It's www.e4.co.za.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to Tech Central today. I hope you get to take that holiday soon, and all the best.
Thank you so much, Duncan. It was a lovely conversation.